The Tom Woods Show, episode 1967.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Before we dive into our topic for today, I want to tell you about a drawing that is taking place very, very soon. I'm talking to you in September 2021, and that is for a free lifetime membership to my libertyclassroom.com website. So we're talking about hundreds of dollars here at stake. How do you get it? Well, let me tell you just for a minute about the Blackbird podcast by my friend James Gentleman. James Gentleman is one of my favorite people in the world I've never met in person. I'm hoping he'll come to the 2000th episode. I've never met him in person, known him online for years. He's a great guy. You may have heard him interview me on his Blackbird podcast. And he's got such a great, smooth radio voice. And he's a great interviewer. He's not a lot of these new podcasters. They've written down a list of questions and they're just going to ask them regardless of what my answers are. And it's totally stilted and it doesn't flow naturally. He interviews so naturally and it's like he's made to do it. And it needs to be listened to. I'm sure there are times when you're out of episodes of The Tom Woods Show. Well, I want you to give this a try. I want you to try Blackbird with James Gentleman. He interviews all kinds of interesting people and he does so without getting, let's say, hysterical, without yelling at the guest. He's extremely thoughtful and informed. It's exactly the kind of podcast you want. It's not a podcast about liberty movement drama. You're not going to find any of that. No interest in that. Okay, I give you a little bit of liberty movement drama every once in a while because that does the soul good. But after a while, it's like saccharine for the soul. So you're not going to get that in the Blackbird podcast. So if you enter to win the Liberty Classroom subscription, even if you lose, you still get something. Anybody who enters gets a 30-day membership to the premium feed of the Blackbird podcast, which means you get early access to interviews, bonus pre-show banter with the guests, and any other premium content he releases. You get that for nothing, and you can enter for nothing. Well, how do you enter? You go to woods.blackbirdpodcast.com. That's woods.blackbirdpodcast.com. So go check that out. Register to win that subscription to Liberty Classroom, which is so worth it. It's so great. You're going to love it. But you'll also love James's podcast. So check that out, woods.blackbirdpodcast.com. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1967. And if you would like a nice shout out like this for a site you're thinking of creating, check out tomwoods.com/publicity for how you get goodies like this from me for nothing. Okay, today we're talking to Daniel Miller. Daniel is president of the Texas Nationalist Movement. He's been an outspoken advocate for Texas independence since 1996, and he is the author of Texit, Why and How Texas Will Leave the Union. Daniel, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Tom.
Do you agree with me that in at least our lifetimes, the lifetimes of you and me specifically, there has never been a better potential at least to get people to listen to the idea of secession?
Well, look, from my viewpoint, it's an inevitability, right? I mean, let's be honest. We go back and we look at, you know, say post-World War II. There were about 54 fully sovereign, recognized countries around the world. By the end of the 20th century, there were 192. Now, those countries did not fall from space. The earth did not get any bigger. What you had were people like us that wanted to reclaim their right of self-government and consequently raise up their specific nation state. So when we're talking about this idea that, you know, maybe people are listening, maybe that, it's literally happening right now. I mean, what we're experiencing is this geopolitical international trend where people just simply want the right to govern themselves. And it's happening every single solitary day.
Well, I think those principles are important and are at the forefront of a lot of people's minds in certain parts of the world at all times. But in particular, 2020 and 2021 has, I think, made as clear as it could be made that in the United States anyway, we clearly are dealing with people who have radically incompatible worldviews. And we keep trying to bash this round hole into the square peg of an indivisible union, whereby every 2 or 4 years we continue to wage war on the half of the country that we can't stand. And it doesn't occur to anybody maybe we don't have to do this. Maybe there is another approach. And the thing is, I find the problem, as I'm sure you encounter, is that even though the concept of secession is quite humane, you know, if you have parties that have irreconcilable differences, the humane solution is not to put them in a boxing ring until one of them collapses. The humane solution is to send them each to their homes to live as they wish. So the idea is certainly harmless. But you mention the word and people go berserk.
Oh, they lose their minds. But, you know, Tom, I mean, there was a lot that you just said there to unpack. And what I'll do is I'll just take the last part first, which is part of the challenge that people have that live in one of the United States is that their historical and cultural touchstone for independence goes back to the 19th century, right? But what we know is that after 1865, the world kept spinning, right? Things kept happening. And that touchstone is not the same for everyone around the world. So frankly, we're all sort of behind the curve a bit. But to your point on the issue of solving these conflicts, you know, we just need to take a look at Sudan. You know, Sudan fought a 30-year civil war. I can't remember how many million were killed in that 30-year civil war. And finally, the solution was North Sudan, South Sudan. And guess what? Peace, you know? So that is the solution. You're right when you say that it's humane. But I want to go back to something that you talked about a moment ago, which is this concept that is really playing out in the news cycle right now, which is we have very incompatible worldviews within this construct, this, you know, political and economic union called the United States of America, where we don't have the same, not the same worldview, but essentially the same core values. And I go back to probably one of the unsung heroes of this idea of states leaving the union in recent memory, and that's Dr. Thomas Naylor. I got to know Dr. Naylor back in, you know, the early 2000s. The doc was, he was a professor emeritus of economics at Duke University, co-wrote a book called Downsizing the USA, and then he wrote a book on his own called Secession. And the great heresy that he spoke was that he believed that tiny little Vermont should break away and become a self-governing independent nation state.
Yeah.
And it was a heresy. You know, I mean, you can imagine with all the natural advantages that Texas has, its size and its economy, things of that nature, the grief that we have gotten over the years. I mean, it was, if they thought I was Don Quixote, they thought he was Sancho Panza, right? I mean, that's how they treated him. They treated him just like a leper. But Dr. Naylor was always steadfast in the one principle, right? Although we disagreed on a lot of things, you know, individual policies, things of that nature. The one thing that we agreed on was that Vermont should govern Vermont and Texas should govern Texas, and we shouldn't try to govern one another. But yet we are, within this system, treated to a ridiculous Punch and Judy show every 2 to 4 years, where one side that is not really ideological representative of the people who vote for it, they go fight over control of a central government that all they want to do is dominate us. So, you know, the fact of the matter is that, as I said, as it's playing out in the news cycle right now, when people come to us and say, well, you know, when is Texas going to happen? I always tell them it's happening right now. You just have to open your eyes and look.
Well, let me raise the question that I think is probably in a lot of people's minds. Let's suppose this did happen. Maybe it's Texas, maybe it's another state, maybe it's Texas and other states. I think the way people imagine it happening is that it would happen along blue and red lines, that the people from the red states have disagreements with people from the blue states and so on and so forth. Now, I personally think that red and blue, you know, that doesn't encompass my entire worldview. I am more sympathetic with red states, and I sure as heck would rather live in a red state in this day and age than live at the mercy of some blue state governor telling me if I can live or not. But there are things about the red states that drive me up a wall too. So it doesn't quite capture everything. But let's say for the sake of argument that it does. The problem that somebody like you would need to address is, how do you deal with the influx of whether it's Californians coming to Texas because they have, you know, they have no idea why California is bad. They just don't like it anymore. And now they're going to come to Texas and make it like California. Or frankly, Mexican immigration, where, I mean, it's not controversial because all you have to do is just look at the data that most of those immigrants are registering Democrat. That's just a fact. In most places, that is what is happening. So how does the prospect, and it does not seem to me like the blue states are really considering secession. California briefly considered it under Trump, but that was just a temper tantrum until their people were in power again, at which time we start talking once again about the indivisible union. So what do you do about the blueification of Texas?
Yeah, again, a lot to unpack, and I'll work it backwards. You know, the fact is that more states than Texas are considering it, including ones that people would call blue states. That recent Brightline survey showed just shy under a majority of Democrats in the Pacific states would be open to and entertain withdrawing from the union, right? So we're seeing this discontent all the way around. I think everyone, regardless of how they vote when they go to the polls, senses this level of discontent and how broken the federal system is. But to your point, though, about the shifting voting demographics, two things. Number one, what we're experiencing here in Texas is definitely historic in the sense that we are witnessing a massive influx from other states. Now, there is a case to be made that says that a lot of this influx are, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say outright that they're just a pack of neo-Marxists, but, you know, you get the drift. They have a tendency more to vote blue or vote Democrat, rather. But that being said, what we're experiencing here in Texas is not necessarily what the perception is. What we're receiving here in Texas right now are people that are essentially political, cultural, and economic refugees from other states, where it has become their core values are not represented in their state government by the majority of the electorate. Places like New York and California, or they're being economically hobbled, or in some instances, they just don't feel safe because of the policies that have been enacted by the government. So we're seeing this influx of political, cultural, and economic refugees, as opposed to the people that are relocating here from, you know, these big tech firms that are leaving and things of that nature. But there is a serious concern here. Now, the one thing that I think we have to talk about that is extremely important, and you mentioned the border issue, but before we even talk about that, the idea, this red versus blue, I had it explained to me pretty bluntly, anecdotally, by a journalist with Texas Public Radio many years ago. He's a gun-owning guy who typically votes Democrat, and he said that he went and visited some of his friends in Massachusetts. And when he told them his stance, that he was pro-right to keep and bear arms, you know, they thought that he was the most right-wing radical that they had ever met. So, you know, let's be honest, this red and blue is kind of a ridiculous dividing line because, again, let us not forget that it wasn't too many years ago that everyone during the presidential election year was trying to convince us that Mitt Romney was the second coming of Ronald Reagan. So, you know, that whole dividing line is very different. We know that red, blue, it's just kind of the way people try to divide this out and conceptualize the differences that we're experiencing. But that being said, you touched on the border issue. And I will tell you from some of the, obviously from what we saw during the Brexit debate and what we've been experiencing here in Texas for the past, you know, well over 20 years now, the border and immigration are going to be the number one drivers for independence, and not just in Texas, but probably in many other states as well.
Let me ask you this. I have a feeling that probably for at least some portion of your life, your first instinct was not Texas needs to secede. I bet, like me, you had more conventional politics at some point. So what I want to know is if that's true, what was it? Was there a straw that broke the camel's back where you said, this thing is just not salvageable? The only solution is secession.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Tom, you know, it's a story. I don't tell it very often when I speak, but on occasion, when I start riffing a bit, I talk about it. But look, all of this is essentially a product of my upbringing. You know, everyone has a journey. Yeah, I was raised in a very blue-collar household. My dad was an iron worker. My mom was a secretary almost to the day that she died. Very blue-collar. Always, you know, enough to get by, but never enough to get ahead. But my parents were always very politically aware. Every evening around the dinner table, nightly news was on, and we discussed current events. You know, I can remember some of my earliest memories of going out with my parents and putting out campaign signs for, you know, state-level candidates, sometimes federal-level candidates. So when I became 18, I did what I saw, right? I did what I was raised to do, which is I went out and I got politically active. I, you know, 18 years old, I ran for mayor of my hometown of 5,000 people. Thank God I came in third, right? I mean, I probably would have been a terrible mayor in retrospect, but you get involved. And a lot of what propelled me led me to a meeting. There was an advertisement in the newspaper, the eagle, the flag, Constitution. I thought, you know, this could be interesting. Let's go see what this is. It led me into the basement of this bank building in downtown. And I was literally the only person other than the organizer, the two brothers that organized it, that showed up. And so after some banter for about an hour, they challenged me and they said, look, here's what we want you to do. We want you to, here's a copy of the U.S. Constitution. Here's a copy of the Communist Manifesto. Go home and read them both, and you tell us what you're seeing in Washington, D.C., which one of these documents it most resembles. And I did. And I got to tell you, Tom, I laugh all the time because I was so young. And being a Cold War kid, I was afraid to be in possession of a copy of the Communist Manifesto, so I hid it under the seat of my car like a drug mule on the way home. But, you know, I took the challenge. And, you know, what I saw there was I saw these, you know, these Marxist principles that were embedding themselves in the federal government. In retrospect, you know, you look at it and you go, wow, okay, so I've been taught this whole time that this was a big war, the West versus the communists. And yet here we are in the process of allegedly defeating the communists. The adoption of those principles in the federal system was almost complete, right? I mean, basically the communist revolution happened without a shot being fired. So it really made me aware. And so I started focusing on the federal side of things. You know, one of the things I really relished the most was chasing Jim Chapman into retirement, Congressman Jim Chapman. His claim to fame was being on the other end of the phone with Bill Clinton when the Monica Lewinsky incident was happening. I mean, that's literally Jim Chapman's only claim to fame, but just chasing him around at his town halls with his voting record. You know, so when we began to engage in these various, you know, things, when we would go and we would try to defend the right to keep and bear arms, you know, all of a sudden it was freedom of speech and the Fourth Amendment that were under attack. And then, I mean, so everywhere you would go and you thought, okay, well, I'm going to go fight this battle, you know, I'm going to go put this fire out, they're lighting 30 more. And it became extremely frustrating because at that moment, you know that all of these things that are happening are really originating in, you know, the Washington District of Criminals. And so it's flowing down and it's affecting each of our lives on an individual basis and just in major ways that I'm sure we won't have time to cover here. But you can't seem to fight against it. And then in August of 1996, I was introduced to the concept of Texas becoming a self-governing independent nation. And as I processed it, it made so much sense. It's like, well, look, if the sewage is flowing from Washington, D.C., then if you cut it off at the borders and we begin to focus on self-government here, well, now we've removed one layer of government that we don't need. We've got the ability to have a government that's close at home, and we can make decisions as Texans and live with those decisions without them being overridden at the stroke of a pen by some unelected, unaccountable federal bureaucrat. So August 24th, 1996, Tom, was the day that I crossed the proverbial line in the sand, and I've been working for Texas independence ever since.
Okay, that's good. So I was afraid you were going to say, nope, I always thought of this idea from the very beginning. Oh, okay, so much for that question. All right, so that's good. I'm glad. Now, let me address something, or have you addressed something that's in your book. You deal with some possible objections, or not even so much objections as they are fears about what might happen or what problems could arise or obstacles you're going to face. And one of them is, and I've heard this a million times, the federal government would never let you go. Well, how do you answer that?
Well, they can't. I mean, when people say that, okay, and you're going to hear me maybe self-edit in the middle of this, because the question, it's such a garbage question, right? It's really, and if you think about it, and I know that you have thought about it because you've been told this a million times, but it's really a throwaway question. Really, it's an excuse, because to answer it, you have to drill down. You know, this idea that, okay, well, the federal government won't let you go. Okay, well, describe what you mean. I mean, are they going to bomb all the Walmarts in Houston? Are they going to empty out Fort Hood and arrest the governor? Are they going to just put a big wall up around Texas and put all 30 million Texans in prison for voting wrong? Because if so, that's actually kind of a result. What shape does that look like? And, you know, you get a lot of questions or a lot of objections like this that are, again, throwaway. People haven't really thought that aspect of it through. They just kind of brush it off. Well, it won't happen, or the federal government won't let you go. Well, tell me how they won't do it. Because if we're following this process, right, a process that we have seen executed for 75 plus years, where the people go to the polls and vote in a referendum, a normal, regular election, and they vote to reassert our status as an independent nation, right? And no one fires on Fort Sumter, right? Then what is it that they do? What is it that the federal government does? And then if you get specific like that, if you require specificity and someone gives you specifics, well, you can bat those things down because they are so implausible, improbable. The fact of the matter is that the moment that the United States federal government acts against any people who engage in a process like I just described, well, 75, 80 years of foreign policy where they've gone and they've sent our grandfathers, our fathers and mothers and our sons and daughters and some of us, some of the people that are listening to this podcast to fight, shed blood and potentially die for the right of self-determination for other people, all of that goes out the window. You know, when you have surveys, when you have polls from noted pollsters like Zogby that show almost half of the active duty military believe that the people, that states have an absolute right to withdraw from the union. When you look at the fact that countries around the world want to trade with us and that the United States, if they were to retaliate against the people who quote unquote voted wrong, you know, they're going to want to, if they wanted to economically embargo, well, that embargo hurts them more than it hurts anyone else. So the fact of the matter is that all of these objections, these project fear planks, are really and truly not rooted in the reality of the situation. When you look at the reality of the situation, if we follow a very set, legal, lawful process and execute on that process, then there's not a lot that they can do other than, you know, act like a bunch of petulant children like Brussels did after the Brexit vote.
Hey, everybody, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor that will help make a better you, and that is Blinkist. Everybody wants to be more confident, more knowledgeable, more able to hold his own in conversation and at parties. We all have a big, long list of books we'd love to get through that would give us that confidence and that knowledge, but we never get to them. Well, that's where the Blinkist app comes in. Blinkist takes top nonfiction titles, pulls out the key takeaways, puts them into text and audio explainers called Blinks that give you the most important information in just 15 minutes. And frankly, let's face it, most books are a whole lot of fluff and very little substance. Now you're going to get the substance that you need and not waste your time. Super efficiency with the Blinkist app. I have a lot of little mini commutes where I'm taking my daughters here and there. And on those little mini commutes, 15 minutes each way, I can have read the equivalent of two books. That's unbelievable. And you can be reading a wide variety of titles, like, for example, What Happened by Hillary Rodham Clinton. You can just get the 15-minute version of what the heck she thinks happened. Or you can abstract from modern day concerns and cast yourself back centuries by listening to or reading the Blinks from Machiavelli's The Prince or Seneca's Letters from a Stoic. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. So what's the mechanism? And I ask this rhetorically because I'm looking right at it in your book, but what's the mechanism by which this would happen? Of course, when the Constitution was ratified, there were special state ratifying conventions for that purpose. And likewise, to reverse that, there were state secession conventions in the South. You seem to be taking a somewhat different approach from that.
Sure. You know, for us, and, you know, it goes without saying, we don't need to cover the implications of Article 1, Section 10 of the U.S. Constitution being silent on the issue of states withdrawing or the 10th Amendment reserving that. Let's look at Texas specifically. Article 1, Section 2 of the Texas Constitution says that all political powers inherent in the people, all free governments are founded on their authority and instituted for their benefit, and the people of Texas have at all times the inalienable right to alter, reform, or abolish their government in such manner as they may think expedient. So our post-Civil War Constitution, Article 1, Section 2, reserves the right to make these determinations to the people. So what that means ultimately for us is we want this to end in a Texas referendum. We want this to be put to a vote of the people. If you go back to Sam Houston's objections to Texas withdrawing from the Union, after the convention met and made the decision for Texas to withdraw from the United States, Sam Houston said that he said that, look, Texas came in via referendum. If we're going to exit, it needs to be put to a vote of the people. Now, some of that might have been political posturing, you know, Sam Houston thinking the people wouldn't vote for it. But he's not wrong from a principle standpoint, because Article 1, Section 2, or some form of those words, have existed in every Texas Constitution since our Republic Constitution of 1836. From a practical implementation standpoint, the challenge that we have here in Texas is there is no statutory framework to make that vote happen. So in this previous session of the Texas legislature, we were able to work with State Representative Kyle Biederman and five other legislators to file the Texas Independence Referendum Act to essentially create a framework for putting this to a vote of the people. So we're, you know, it did not pass in this session, but we're moving forward on this particular framework because the opportunity actually exists for us to not only have this referendum framework placed into statute, but we can also in the next session go the constitutional amendment route as well and make the constitutional amendment effectively the referendum. So at the end of the day, as long as the question is clearly put to a vote of the people of Texas and the people of Texas make the decision to Texas, then we're on solid ground.
Again, I'm not saying that this is a reason not to do it. Believe me, I think it should be done. But just to think about, can you imagine the propaganda campaign against that from all the blue check marks and all the respectable circles and everything? I mean, sometimes we do some small thing and they go berserk. I mean, these are the sort of people, if there's one Hollywood actor with an opinion 10% different from the other Hollywood actors, they want to destroy his career. Sure. If you're actually talking about something as quote-unquote extreme as withdrawal from the Union, you can't imagine. These people would just have heart attacks. It would be absolute pandemonium.
Hey, Tom, they need to get their story straight, right? Half of them would want to donate against us, right, to keep Texas in. But frankly, the other half that would be freaking out would probably want to donate to kick us out.
Yeah, so, right. I don't understand why they don't just kick you out and just say, well, then the other 49 will now have a slightly easier time of it because we're not saddled by Texas.
I mean, look, they want to make D.C. a state. Just give them our star. I mean, you know, let's just go that route. But, you know, look, we are not naive about how tough this campaign is, right? I mean, look, I've been at this for 25 years now. Our organization, the Texas Nationalist Movement, wasn't formed until 2009, and it took 4 years of capacity building for us to make our first engagement with the Texas legislature. So, you know, we are not unaware, and we have, as an organization, built our structure around what will eventually have to come, which is an on-the-ground campaign. Look, we saw this. We saw the Brexit referendum, and we saw what happened. And it was proof that we were moving in the right direction, but more so that we were right about how we organized the T&M from day one. Look, they're going to blow the propaganda out of the water. But Tom, here's what we know. We know that the polling shows if we go to a referendum tomorrow, we win. And we don't win by a little, we win by a lot. Now, what I think is more important, though, beyond the poll numbers, is really the two cases that are going to be laid out. We know what their case is going to be. It's going to be touchy-feely. It's going to be better together. You know, they're going to make the assertion that, you know, Texas will turn into the next Afghanistan with the Taliban in charge and will be horrible for human rights. That's already started up a bit. They'll propagandize and tell everyone that, you know, that means that they're going to cut the Social Security off and grandma die in a ditch. Again, garbage. So that we know what their side is. But what our side is pretty straightforward. Right now, we know that the backs of Texas taxpayers are being broken by the enormous tax burden foisted upon us by Washington, D.C. They are stealing from our pockets. They're taking about 40% of our take-home pay that we never see again. We're overpaying anywhere from $103 to $160 billion annually into the federal system. That's an overpayment. We know that the number one top polled concern for Texas voters when combined is the border and immigration. The federal government has effectively destroyed the southern border with Mexico. We have a massive flood of illegal immigration that is creating havoc, public safety concerns, and just, I mean, that's a whole other topic that we could talk about for an hour, Tom, is the negative impact of federal government border and immigration policy on Texas. And Texas is disproportionately affected by it. It is a mess. So that's number two. And we know Texas gives us the ability to reclaim our right to manage our own border and our own immigration policy. And since we're the ones that have to deal with it on the daily, who better to manage our border than us? And then here's the final thing, Tom, and what our case to the people of Texas is, and I have literally crisscrossed Texas for years, putting it to people this way. It's simply this. If you imagine for a moment that Texas, or frankly any state, was currently a self-governing independent nation in every respect of the word, right? We had our own monetary system. We had our own control of our own immigration and border policy, our own military, our own defense policy, our own passports, you know, in every respect. You know, we even had our own Olympic team, right? And instead of talking about Texas, we were talking about whether or not our self-governing independent nation should join the United States. Knowing what we know about those 180,000 pages of federal laws, rules, and regulations and the 2.5 million unelected bureaucrats and everything, knowing what we know about the federal government, would you vote to join the union today?
Yeah, that's a great question. That right there. And by the way, when you look back at the arguments that were made, you know, with this is why we need to have the Constitution— in your textbook, the Articles of Confederation is made to sound like an obviously stupid document and nobody liked it, and it was obvious that we needed the Constitution. Now, even if you accepted the arguments at that time, well, you know, we'd like to have a big free trade zone and we'd like to have a better common defense and we want the states to pull their weight and whatever, you know, you could see somebody going for that. But as you say, if you look ahead a couple hundred years, you might say, well, I think I'll take my chances with some of these other problems compared to how it actually turned out.
Yeah, it's amazing because, you know, there was a thought at the time, and I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but, you know, there was a thought at the time when Texas joined the union that these political unions were sort of the way to go, you know, as these fledgling states, they needed to band together and do some things. And it's, look, it's a very 18th, 19th century solution. But, you know, in the 20th century, we began to see nation states organizing themselves in many respects, like the United States, without giving up their sovereignty, right? Without joining these absolute political and economic unions to be ruled by someone else. And I talk about it in the book where, you know, you take an issue like trade, right? You can look at the United States as one piece of it as a free trade agreement. But then you realize that the United States actually has free trade agreements with 22 other self-governing independent nation states around the world, right? That are, if you look at the trade agreements, are effectively on the same or in some instances better terms than the states have with one another within the union, right? So, you know, you have these 22 other self-governing independent nations that do not have to bow a knee to the 2.5 million unelected bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., but yet they get to benefit from free trade. And so you look around the world and you say, okay, look, these things are handled by, you know, multilateral agreements or international conventions without anyone having to give up their right of self-government. Well, that's a 20th and 21st century solution. And it's one of the reasons, Tom, that we see that, you know, so much pushback against the EU. You know, the EU is wanting to become the United States of Europe. They're trying to pattern themselves after the United States of America. And in doing so, they're getting a tremendous amount of pushback. That's because it's an 18th and 19th century solution to 20th and 21st century problems. If Texas or any state wanted to go it alone, you wouldn't have to go it alone. All you have to do is engage in the same activities that other self-governing independent nations around the world engage in every single solitary day on trade and travel and, you know, mutual defense and all of those things. In effect, what the Constitution of the United States was meant to do by the founders and the framers could effectively be accomplished by the use of these various agreements at whatever levels we want. And, you know, without having to bow a knee to some city of bureaucrats who think that they are smarter than the rest of us.
You know, Daniel, I usually like to wrap up these conversations with a big picture question, but I'm going to do the opposite this time, just because there's something that you mentioned just now and also is in your book that I think the average person might be curious about. And it's rather than a big philosophical question, it's just a technical question. Mm. And that has to do with programs like Social Security. Now, regardless of how people listening to this feel about it, if you say in an independent Texas, all that is wiped out, you're going to be killed when you go for the referendum. So the question would be, what kind of transition do you envision for programs like that?
Well, the beautiful part is, again, I talk about this in the book, is that there is this misconception by a lot of folks that we go to the polls, we vote for Texit. The day after Texit, it's, you know, it's Mad Max. It is, you know, The Walking Dead. It is, you know, insert any apocalyptic movie that you could possibly imagine. Daniel Miller and Tom Wood road trip through the apocalyptic wasteland, formerly known as Texas, right? It's not how it works. It kicks off a process, and so many of these issues are dealt with in one of the stages of that process, either the transitional phase or the negotiation phase. But let's take an issue like Social Security, and I even mention sort of that argument from the opposition. You know, they already started it up about Texit means you're going to let grandma die in a ditch, right? And that's just sort of a backhanded thing about Social Security. But look, let's look at current federal policy related to Social Security. As someone who is a Social Security pension recipient, right? If you're receiving Social Security money right now and you move outside of the United States, as long as you don't move to North Korea, Belarus, Syria, or Cuba, you still get your Social Security payments, right? So the question then becomes, all right, well, what about those people that are sort of in between? They've got work credits here, but they're not yet ready to retire out and collect their check. Well, the most likely scenario is the scenario that plays out around the world, right, through many Western civilized countries, which is what are called totalization agreements. In essence, if you work in one country and earn in their Social Security program, and then you move to another country and you earn in their Social Security program, your work credits are totaled up through these totalization agreements, and you don't lose any type of work credits that you've earned. Now, the question then becomes, okay, well, Texas doesn't have one of those systems. Well, actually, Texas has pieces of those systems. Number one is Texas already has a state retirement system that could be expanded. But more importantly, we have a model that's been played out for about 20 years now in three Texas counties. You probably heard it referred to as the Galveston Plan, but you had about 20 years ago, three Texas counties opt out of Social Security for their county employees and allow them to pay into what became known as the Galveston Plan. It was Galveston, Fort Bend, and Brazoria counties. And what you find is after a 20-year track record, the counties that were on the Galveston plan outperformed Social Security by a mile. as far as what the return on investment was. So, you know, for us to be able to spin up something, we're not starting at zero, right? We already have the elements in place that we can put into place, not quite from day one, but really early in the transition process. So, you know, all of these issues that are kind of technical and mechanical, you know, we answer those on our website at techsitnow.org. And, you know, not only that, the foundation for understanding how to answer those questions is in my book, TechSit.
And indeed, I am linking to that book at tomwoods.com/1967, which is our show notes page for today. It's TechSit, Why and How Texas Will Leave the Union. I strongly recommend it. But also, I presume you have a website with a lot of information you might want to direct people to. So if so, let us know what that is.
Sure, absolutely. I would encourage folks to go visit our website. For the TechSit questions, they can go to TechSitNow.org. If you want to learn more about the Texas Nationalist Movement and our work, you can go to TNM.me. That's TNM.me. And then if anyone wants to know more personally about what I'm doing, they can go to DanielOMiller.com.
Okay, very good. I'll have both of those links up at tomwoods.com/1967. If, in case I said 1867, I keep doing that. It's like I'm afraid of the coming of 2000 for some reason. But 1967 is the show notes page for this episode number 1967. Well, thank you, Daniel, for this. And let's hope for the sake of not just of Texans, but for everybody that something like this happens and soon.
Tom, thank you so much for having me on and speaking with me to talk about this subject that is obviously near and dear to my heart.
All right, folks, that's our episode. Now, remember, all the normal people are gathering in Orlando October 16th, 2021 for the 2000th episode of The Tom Woods Show. It is going to be a spectacular event you are not going to want to miss. So go register for that. Doesn't cost you a thing to attend. This is my gift to you. And by the way, it's a pretty darn big gift. This thing costs a fortune. So show up. Anyway, check out, get all the details at tomwoods2000.com, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.